This episode of Hacks and Flacks was recorded on the 2nd of December 2022, when the UK had prepared for rail strikes on the run-up to Christmas. Netflix had shared a trailer for forthcoming docu-series Harry and Meghan, and the annual Winter Wonderland event in London's Hyde Park was in full swing for the festive season.
Hello and welcome to Hacks and Flacks with me, Petri Hoskin. Hacks and Flacks is the only series where you'll get the inside scoop on how journalist hacks and the flacks of government and business work behind the scenes to decide which stories you'll be reading with your morning coffee, and perhaps more importantly, how they keep certain headlines off the front pages. What happens if a public figure is the subject of a salacious story? When does a scandal make or break a career? And how do you really know what is or isn't fake news? All these subjects and a whole lot more will be explored by me and a regular panel of hacks and flacks, ready to spill the beans and tell us how the sausages get made. Flacks like former government advisers Giles Kenningham.
Hello.
And Andrew McDougall.
Hello.
Plus hacks like Mick Booker.
Hello.
So now all the gang's here, let's delve into the world of hacks and flacks.
Hello and welcome to Hacks and Flacks with me, Petri Hoskin. Now, I'm very much looking forward to this week's episode, as this is a subject I usually try very hard to avoid for reasons which will soon become clear. Today, we're talking super injunctions. But what are they? Why would you try to get one? And how? Well, joining me in the pursuit of the truth are two men with absolutely nothing to hide, regular panellists Mick Booker and Giles Kenningham. Hello. Giles, nothing from you? Hello?
No.
He's keeping super quiet on super injunctions.
Exactly.
Well, let's start with the basics. Mick, we'll come to you for this. What is a super injunction?
It's like Fight Club. The first rule of super injunction club is you can't mention super injunction club. That's the thing. So a normal injunction is where it's a court order that prevents you from saying something specific or a specific action. Whereas a super injunction, you can't even reveal who's got the injunction. So it's very, very specific. And so there's a few out there and we can't say who's got them. And that's the beauty of them.
But we know they are there. We shouldn't really know they're there, should we? So how do we know not to guess?
Well, I'm guessing we know some of them, or we think we know some of them, but there's plenty that we don't. I think that's kind of the point. I think there is.
But then you can trip over it, you can accidentally...
But you see the press sometimes, like, you know, if you know who the injunction is, you can see the kind
we
of coded, the coded stories appearing in the press. Do you know what I mean?
But that's the point, isn't it? But
now, doing my great research for this,
yes,
because right, I'm just a journalistic chunk of coal, no legal expert, but the original purpose of these things was to prevent vigilantism against criminals. But it's morphed into something else, and it's something that the rich do to stop people poking their noses in. So these things, by definition, cost a lot of money because you need to do it very quickly and you've got to have someone working. So they're saying it's about £50,000 alone for the initial injunction. And then it extends to, well, £200,000 once you factor in the follow-up court appearances, and then it snowballs from there. So it's only the preserve of the super rich or someone who's got something massive to hide.
But how? I mean, I thought we were all equal in the law. So that we're not, then.
You fool.
Well, I didn't think that. I thought that's what they say.
Although, to your point, Petri, is true, but I think these days it is still easier, or there's a higher threshold about what needs to make it into the press than there previously was. So loads of stories get knocked out, don't make the front page because of privacy issues. The public interest test has to be so high now, whereas before, in the days of the News of the World, like, it was pretty much carte blanche, anything goes. Whereas now, loads of stories about people's private lives do not make the papers because there isn't perceived to be a public interest test, which is why, much to Mick's disappointment, you don't see many of those shagging stories on the front page of the Daily Star or, you know, the Sun anymore. It's often buy-ups or serialisations of people's books and things like that.
You say my disappointment, but there was a period when I was on the Sunday Express and we didn't have an awful lot of money. It was a great leveller that no one else had them. So they'd come down to, you know, they had to go back to, you know, normal stories. So it's good in many ways that we've all got the same stuff to pick over.
What is there, and this is the point I was making a moment ago, if you don't know there is a super injunction, right? If so, just let's imagine a world where, I mean, we're saying we don't, there are some out there yep. we don't know about. What is to stop a journalist from accidentally tripping over the story and releasing it if they don't know there's an super injunction on it?
Well, because the newspapers, the lawyers and the newspapers yeah. admit we'll know much more. Not,
if
much
you're
going to
start blabbing
know,
that out on Twitter, then you deserve all you get,
yeah,
really.
But you'll know,
you
like,
that story.
The in-house lawyers will know this. You know, certain cases are
they
subject.
Will always know, will yeah. they? Yeah.
Well, and again, if it's something so sensitive that you think this is a great story, then you need to check that story out. And if you then check out that story and say, and then you go to that person and then they say, well, their people say, well, there is injunction about this. Yeah. Then you're not going to do it.
That's assuming you would give them the right of response. Or
well,
the
then
right
again,
of reply.
Well, if you don't, and if it's this great story, I presume they're just being reckless. Then, if you're
well,
just
then you end
publish
up,
it.
You could end up in prison or for contempt of court.
Yeah.
So, Giles, as PR, have you ever recommended anybody to get an injunction or a super injunction?
Yeah, we have, when we've dealt with high-profile person who had a load of data stolen. Information where there was, you know, you've had all these infamous hacking of the cloud and such things where it is personal data of which there is no public interest to report that. And actually now I think, to my earlier point, you don't necessarily always need a super injunction to keep that information out, but some people want, who can afford it, the security of doing that.
So did they do it? And it's held and everyone's lived happily ever after?
Yeah. I mean, I was still of the case, I didn't necessarily think they needed to get one, mm-hmm. but it was that thing of that extra level of just reassurance. Because I think the public interest for doing the story was zilch.
But again, if we don't know there's one there, we can't challenge it. And presumably it's the job of journalists to challenge these super injunctions.
And they have, haven't they?
Yeah. Or politicians just blurt it out in Parliament.
Which they can.
Well, you saw Philip Green, okay? There were a number of alleged harassment
cases. Because they got parliamentary privilege.
And Telegraph was running front page of stories without mentioning Philip Green. Then Lord Hayne, Peter Hayne, the former cabinet minister, just blurted out in the Lords. Ryan Giggs, when he was caught red-handed having a couple of affairs, there was a super injunction out on that. And then he was pictured on the front page of a Scottish newspaper. Obviously, there's a different legal system in Scotland, I think, with his eyes cut out, but as obviously he was. Then a Lib Dem MP named in Parliament as well. And then there was carte blanche. And there is a danger with them that you elevate and make something much more of a big story. There have been cases where something may have been page 10 in the paper. They get super injunction out, it's temporary. It then gets lifted, which gives it, you know, the rocket boosters. And then the press often will go harder in on that story, and so you make it a bigger deal. So it can end up in a complete PR disaster, and you're staving off the inevitable. Obviously, it can buy you time as well.
But the other thing is, looking at it from the other angle, a lot of these super injunctions, I know we've talked a bit about stumbling across them.
Yeah.
But a lot of them are there because journalists have already asked that question. And then they've gone to gag the press with this. So the first one was, it was Trafigura, who had been dumping toxic waste off the Ivory Coast. Now, The Guardian had this story. They were going to say, they were talking about how it led to health problems across that area. And the firm representing Trafigura, the company involved, they rushed to court, got the super injunction, and it meant The Guardian weren't able to publish the article to start with. But then that started leaking onto WikiLeaks, and then it came from there. And then in the end, the super injunction fell apart. So a lot of this is because of journalists finding these stories and people saying, well, not wanting them to be published.
But how do you get one? I mean, particularly in that case that you've just mentioned there, Mick, that would be in the public interest for a story like that to come out. So is it just about paying the money? Is it just about having enough money to silence to get
But a judge, that the judge must have agreed that there was a reason why that was. Now, I can't think of any reason why he would.
Yeah.
Again, just looking in my detailed research before coming on, the conditions for granting a super injunction. First of all, there's an interim order while they work it out. And they said, to be granted, the judge will need to be satisfied there is a justifiable reason with a strong argument. Now, again, if you're saying, you know, that sounds very much like a public interest thing, that people are, the toxic waste is affecting whether, you know, the testing hadn't been clear or that people were being ill, and then that would have been huge reputational damage to Trafigura straight away. Maybe the judge thought, well, let's give it, let's the Guardian have some time to actually prove this is the case. So, you know, they're, you can see why a judge would do that because, you know, there's a lot of money at stake.
Yeah, you can see, like, certainly the temporary ones, why they happen, because, you know, there's a rush to judgment. People want to get the facts in front of them. So I can see more of the case why judges do that a lot of the time.
Listen, just before we move on, I just want to have explained parliamentary privilege, if we can, because we mentioned there that, that when, you know, people are in the chamber, that they can literally say almost anything without fear of a legal action.
Yeah. And you see...
How has that happened? Why has that happened?
We should ask Mick, because Mick's done his research. I don't actually know the sort of historical thing, but to your point, like, it is used a fair bit, and sometimes I think it's used quite recklessly, you know, because, like, say, people don't have carte blanche without any consequence to what they're saying. But I'm not sure of the...
Well, no, but that chamber is a sacrosanct place for people to be able to speak their mind and speak for the people, isn't it? So in that way, it has to be privileged there. And but they have to. It comes with a huge responsibility, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know, because we get partial privilege as well through the law to be able to report on what is said in there as well and without being sued. So that's why we can then report on what they're saying, because we have that privilege as long as it's contemporaneous and it's in reaction to what's happened that day or that week or whatever in Parliament. But it's a very important tool, but it can't be abused, otherwise then...
So in Parliament, they could literally break a super injunction. They can just do that whenever they want to, and they've done it.
Yeah, Ryan Giggs and Philip Green both got broken in Parliament. I remember seeing Louise Mensch and Piers Morgan go at it, have a right spat, where she made comments about him in relation to phone hacking, all of which, I would add, he denied. But he was there going, say it outside the chamber, say it outside the chamber, which obviously she never would. So
do you think that should be changed? Because, you know, if we're looking at super injunctions and why they're given, or injunctions of any kind, that actually, you know, that privilege was clearly given in the days before there were broadcasters and media and TikTok and Twitter. Now, if it's said in Parliament, and we're watching Parliament all the time, well, some people are, that actually that should be changed now.
They don't happen very often, do they? And I think that says to me that the MPs are using them when they're really necessary. So I think to take that away, start chipping away at those sort of freedoms of Parliament is a very dangerous game. It's thin ice, to be perfectly honest. If MPs were finding out about super injunctions and blabbing every couple of days, then you'd think, there's clearly a problem. But I think at the moment it's a very important tool for Parliament to have, and necessarily, you know, for justice in this country.
Let's move on to the PR angle of this. And one name comes to mind is Max Clifford. And one time I talked to him... because I was doing a paper review with him on a programme. And he said, look, I wasn't paid for what I got in the paper, I was paid for what I keep out of it. Giles, is that something that runs through you as somebody who works with these companies?
Sometimes you are paid to keep stuff out of the paper, but I always think that, you know, if you do manage to keep it out, there'll be a very good reason for it. One of the classic tricks of journalists and papers is to try and get people to deny something that, you know, may never have happened. But if they go on the record and deny it, they've got a story. It's a bit like me going to you, Petri, you're a crook. And you go, no, I'm not a crook. Fine, thanks. Last night, Petri was forced to deny she was a crook.
Yeah.
And you see this when they've got speculative stories which haven't got any foundation or substance behind them. So look, I think there's going to be a good case for them. And often you can be protecting people's privacy. There won't be a public interest to that story appearing. And everyone deserves representation, right?
The thing that Max Clifford had as well was he had a bit more leverage in that way with certain editors, because...
Did you know where the bodies were buried?
No, not so much that. I mean, maybe he did, I don't know, but...
I always felt that he did.
Because he was Max Clifford, the guy that all the tabloids go to, if anyone did have a story, they'd always go to Max Clifford. So if he said on a certain story to an editor... well, if you print that, you're not going to get any access to any of my other stuff, then that's clearly going to be a problem to them. I'm not saying that happened, but you can imagine that sort of thing happening. But Max Clifford was, you know, the PR at that time, wasn't it? And if,
he was.
So
yeah.
You know, if you know someone just from you know, the streets of Sunderland or whatever had this great story about sleeping with a footballer or something like that, they wouldn't think of you know Trafalgar PR or something like that.
Max Clifford.
Yeah. So that was a big power that he had in that way. But I think if any PR normally rings up and tries to keep a story out, then that's usually a red rag to a bull, and you do everything you can to get that story in. So it just depends on who the PR is or who the company is, I think, sometimes. And going back to someone like Max Clifford, he had that power because he, you know, he cornered the market in those stories.
If we look at the press, right, we look at papers, and you know that somebody's got a super injunction, and you know who it is, and you know what the story is, how much do you fight to get that super injunction lifted?
Well, again, it's money a lot of the time, isn't it? And I think when the likes of, well, Max Clifford ended up going after them, I think it was in John Terry's case when he was trying to keep an extramarital affair out of the press, and then Max ended up looking after the woman involved in that. I think a lot of the tabloids, you know, spent a lot of money to try and get that lifted. In the end, it was lifted, and it ran for over weeks and weeks and weeks. You know, it was Wayne Bridge was his teammate. The story was that John Terry had slept with this woman. Again, I think in the end, the apologies were made by the newspapers who printed that story in the end anyway. So I think a lot of that was denied. But it was a huge story at the time, and it was huge for the tabloids, and it was obviously it's all about selling tabloids. Yeah. And that was, you know, John Terry, England captain, you had him supposedly sleeping with a teammate's girlfriend. So it was a huge story. And in those days, when you know the News of the World sold 2 million copies, 3 million copies, the Sunday Mirror was selling a million. It was a huge, huge.
Do you reckon
business.
That story would make it into the papers these days? I don't think you'd need a super injunction to keep it out. You'd just be like, it's privacy. There's no public interest. John Terry says, look, I'm not a publicly elected official. I don't lecture on family values, so you can't get him on the hypocrisy charge. He's not taxpayer funded, so you know.
See, he argued
if he'd been I suppose the case for Duke would be like, as England captain, you know, you've got an important, high profile public position, you know, you represent the country. But I still think even now it'd be very, very difficult to get that in.
See, he argued he should get the super injunction because it said it would adversely affect his private life. The judge rejected it because he said it was really to restrain the details was financial. Was the reason because he thought he wouldn't get his
sponsorship
things like that. The next contract, people would think less of him, so they wouldn't be spending out. So in that case, you know, the judge decided, well, no, I'm afraid, you know, you've made your bed, now lie in it, literally,
or not lie in it. We mentioned public interest and interesting to the public. We've mentioned that quite a lot. Can we just talk through that? Because there must be a very fine line on some occasions because you see. You know, footballers, for example, and they are, you know, followed by little boys and hero worshipped, and they're a role model. We hear this expression quite a lot. As a role model, perhaps you shouldn't be, you know, sleeping with other people's girlfriends. As a role model, perhaps you shouldn't be taking drugs. As a role model, perhaps you shouldn't, you know, any of these things.
Yeah.
Surely that is in the public interest. I think it must be a very thin veil between the two sometimes.
I mean, Mick will have a better view than me, but I think ever since Leveson, to my earlier point, the threshold for privacy has become very high, or threshold for getting stories into the paper. So I don't think those stories would appear. And lo and behold, I mean, how many kiss and tell stories do you get in the papers now? Not that many
not
at
there.
All. Very ready. I mean, the last one, wasn't a kiss and tell, but the last huge, salacious kind of sex scandal was probably the Matt Hancock affair with his aide. And obviously,
and that was only because he carried it out at work.
Yeah, and the fact that the video came in as well. It wasn't someone selling the story.
I can't unsee that video.
That was very much in the public interest. He was the health minister at the time of COVID. There was that guidance still going around, and he was breaking the guidance. So that got into the paper.
But could he have argued that that was his private life?
I'm sure he did make that argument when he got the phone call from the Sun. But at the same time, I think given what we'd gone through as a country at that point, he was the health minister, again, breaking that guidance, which had, you know, even now in I'm a Celebrity, he's still trying to talk his way out of that one, wasn't he, in the last few weeks. So
I think also the real difficulty came was that his lover was on the public on the payroll. Yeah. So you've got your lover on the payroll, then it becomes very, very tricky. If a cabinet minister was having an affair with one of their special advisors, it, in my mind, open and shut case, you're gone, done, game over, you have to resign.
I was chatting with a friend over a few glasses of vino not long ago, and we were discussing one of our former prime ministers, and I know there's been quite a few recently, so I won't mention names, on whom I'd heard some gossip, right? Yeah. And about their sex life and carrying on with people they may or may not be working with in a salacious and frankly, really interesting in terms of gossip way. And she said, why don't we know about this? Because that would make a difference if people were voting for this person. Mm. They would say, well, if that person carries on like this in their private life, then I definitely wouldn't vote for them. But that person could argue that that was their private life, and yet it would affect people's voting.
I think if you can get them on hypocrisy, yeah, it's like, you know, you're away at the races, right? If that person...
But it's getting the proof.
The public about family values and this, you know, the importance of family and being the bedrock of society whilst at the same time having an affair or multiple lovers, then I think you've got a very strong case for doing that. If they've never said anything about it, back in the day of News of the World, have been fine. These days, very hard. I mean, I know there's quite a few stories about certain MPs knocking around, which... have not made the papers.
No.
If you're like a single person, you go, well, I'm a single person, you know, maybe having multiple affairs, but so what? I'm entitled to do that. I'm not married, you know.
But again, it's having the proof. It's all well and good us all gossiping about it, saying, oh, you know, I've heard this, this is the kick.
Very good source then.
No, well, yeah, it's a very good source.
How
but
how
then it's putting that in onto a TV screen, putting it into a newspaper and being able to stand up and say, I can prove that, and that's, you know, the journalist's job at the end of the day. You know, there's a story knocking around at the moment that the son of got about a Tory MP who's been reported for, I think it's to the police about, and it's a third party complaint. I think it's a sexual offence. Now, speaking to people today, I mean, it's very, very tight-lipped as to who that person is, and understandably so as well. So, I mean, just getting to that point will have taken a hell of a lot of work from the Sun. So, and that's without the person being named. In the olden days, they may have just gone ahead and named them, but even they're being very, very cautious about that because it could have huge repercussions on that person's career, that person's life, that person's family.
There is a case at the moment, isn't there, where an MP was barred from the House. And other MPs were saying, well, look, if everybody of that sort of age group, if all the men of that age group turn up, then we'll know who's not here. That's gone very, very quiet. Is that a super injunction?
Not that I'm aware of. But again, it's just we just have to be incredibly cautious.
He was accused of some terrible things.
Yeah. But again, it's if we think we know who it is and we've got this really strong argument to put it in the newspaper or put it on the television, then that's our job.
But everybody knows who it is.
I think with that MP, though, I think the issue is... they have not been charged. So I think if they get charged, they'll get named.
Right.
In the old days, they'd often would release the person's name because they'd say, look, this could be part of a pattern of behaviour to encourage other victims to come forward. Are allegations? But I think for that person, they won't be named unless they get charged.
Yeah.
Because there's obviously a strong
case. But
it's just
gone very quiet. Yeah. So
but then you go back to Cliff Richard and the BBC.
Because suppose they don't get... Exactly, suppose... They're found not guilty, but they've had their name, or suppose they never get charged, but they've had their name plastered all across the press.
Cliff Richard, when the BBC's had the police raid in his house, they had the helicopter going over it, and he hadn't even been, he wasn't charged with anything, wasn't arrested over anything. It was, and then people have been very cautious ever since then.
Because they had to pay out, I don't know if it was record amounts, but it was hundreds of thousands on a breach of privacy, right?
Yeah, it's not their money.
It's our money. I want a rebate.
But then it's put off everyone else from going there and putting the names out
there.
So it
does the trick.
Yeah.
Can we just address what a press blackout is as opposed to a super injunction? Because there are moments in history where the press universally agree not to talk about a particular personal topic.
You often get the situation when, say, if a prime minister is going into a war zone, so with Boris Johnson recently going... to Ukraine, there was a press blackout, I think, until he'd left. They then released the pictures, and that's for security reasons. There was one when Prince Harry went to Afghanistan and was fighting for security reasons as well. So I think that was, I think we were just talking about this before we started recording this episode, that I think the Drudge report you were saying, Mick,
yeah, well,
in America,
I was at the Daily Star Sunday at the time as deputy editor, and representatives from all the newspapers and all the news outlets had an agreement with, it was by the Society of Editors and the Ministry of Defence and obviously the Royal Family as well, where we'd have meetings. We were first of all told that Prince Harry was going out there. He was a young man, wanted to serve his country, wanted to serve his grandmother, wanted to have a life. And what, could we agree to this blackout? And it was in return for, when he did come back, we'd have access to, you know, there was some good footage of him out there. There was going to be some great stills. There was going to be some words from him as well. But it was a case of, this young man, he wants a fairly normal life, and as much as he can do, can we give him a chance? And there was an agreement. And again, when you look at it now through with the way that Prince Harry feels as though he's been treated by the press, this was something where, look, you know, he deserves a life. So we all went along with it, because, again, it was going to be, when it was revealed, it was going to be a great story as well. So that was a good thing for us. Mm. But unfortunately, I think in the end, after, I think he was there for a few months, and then I think it ended up being leaked on the Drudge report. He ended up being flown out of Afghanistan.
He was angry about that, wasn't he?
Well, he was angry about it. And again, he probably thinks of the press as a whole still badly as a result of that, whereas the British press as a whole was doing everything it could to keep that quiet, just so he could go out and experience his job, what he wanted to do, and serve his country.
How do those conversations take place? So it is a bartering system, is it? You say, look, okay, we'll keep quiet, but we want this.
Well, no, I think they expect it to be a bartering system, and there was, there was lengthy, I can't remember the exact details of those meetings at the Ministry of Defence. There were lots of us in a big room being told this is what's happening. But again, I think they approached the Society of Editors. They organised us all to go, and it was just, you know, most of us are reasonable, common sense people, and we saw that, you know, look, yeah, he does want to go out. Mm. He wants to serve his country. He's putting himself in a very, very dangerous position as it is anyway. He's, you know, like everyone who serves his country and does that, incredibly brave and, you know, putting themselves at risk for us. So if he's wanting to do that, we should give him every possible opportunity to do that. And most people in the press saw that, fair play to him, good luck to him, and we'll do everything we can to protect that.
What if government asked you to black out on something that you morally felt was objectionable? Would you black out?
Again, it depends what it is. But if they are, if it is something in terms, I presume it's something for national security, then you'd be a fool not to. If you, you know,
as a journalist, you'd have to still tell the story.
Well, no, I don't think. I think if again, it's a case by case thing, isn't it? But if they're going to that extent to say it's a blackout, then they don't use that power lightly, and I can't see, you know, in terms of when I was editor of the Sunday Express, you know, I feel as though I'd have to go along with it reluctantly, even if I did morally think it was wrong.
Was there any story where you thought, God, we should have actually gone with that?
Not that I can think of in terms of blackouts, because I can't think of any particular ones apart from the Prince Harry one, which was more of an agreement rather than a blackout anyway.
But, I mean, what if it was something like, I don't know, that we were facing nuclear war and they said, look, we don't want to start panic, we don't want anyone to know.
I'd then corner the market in nuclear bunkers during, at that point.
You haven't got time.
I actually thought during COVID there was times when there was stuff which was just unhelpful because it was speculative and it just caused more panic.
Yeah,
there actually should have been an agreement of maybe, I mean, and maybe there was stuff which was blacked out, which we don't know about, but it felt like there was stuff which was really, really unhelpful, which served no public interest.
Test. Apart from fear.
Apart from fear, yeah, exactly.
But at that time, you got the impression that particularly, I remember on some Saturdays before a Sunday, particularly in the early days when things were fairly febrile, they didn't know what they were doing anyway.
They didn't know, nor really knew the implications.
They didn't know what they were doing, but then even with something as simple as an embargo till 10 o'clock on a story, you know, if there's an embargo on a story that, Boris Johnson doesn't want you to see your mother on Mother's Day, you think, wow, this is terrifying. You know, there's that sort of thing. But they were just, from where I could see, they were just making it up as they went along. But at the same time, they've got these great powers to make everything. We're making it up as they go along, but this is a certainty. And I think that was the problem that people had.
Yeah. You mentioned embargoes there. They're very interesting to me because as a broadcaster, I always obey an embargo, right? But some of them are placed on the most ridiculous stories, like, you know, more people eat apples and oranges, embargoed until midnight.
Well, it's the power of the PR, isn't it, the embargo?
What is that about?
It's always, it's all about just trying to time, just sort of control the timing of a story so it goes out on your terms to get the maximum amount of publicity. But I always thought it was always cock-up rather than conspiracy, but the stories we'd get more bang for our buck for were when people broke embargoes accidentally or purpose. So I remember we were briefing
so
the story.
To...
Well, no, I remember we were briefing a story round when I worked for the Conservatives about the fact UKIP had a racist builder in their big party political broadcast. So it was kind of, you know, not a bad story, probably middle of the book sort of story out there. And the Mirror broke the embargo like at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and it just caused an absolute shitstorm. You know, it called, made it a much bigger story. The BBC Six then ran it, James Lander. We actually got much more out of it by default. So it's a bit like when we say, like, you know, the best way to get a story out is to walk down Downing Street with embargoed secret across something, which is a crap story, which is, you know, of no consequence. But everyone's like, oh, you know, it's top secret, therefore it is a story. So, yeah.
It's like your equivalent having a big red button that's do not touch.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But you're right, like people would break them, and sometimes it would cause chaos, or sometimes it just meant that you lost control of the news agenda, often in government, especially when you're in a different time zone, so you're trying to work out. You know,
I just look at the embargoes and go, what on earth is this about?
So also to be fair, like, there is no consequence. What's someone going to do to you?
This is
what I mean, though.
I just kind have honour.
It's kind of bullshit, because at the end of the day, you
no,
only rely
but there
on
is,
goodwill.
There is consequence. On... Having worked at the slightly less funded end of the tabloid market sometimes, if there is certain PRs who, if you do, you know, mess
about
with...
They hold back stories from...
Yeah, they will then hold back stories
for years.
I mean,
that's the power you've got. It's like, that's what you do. But, I mean, there's actually no direct consequence straight away. As Mick said, it will sour your relationship, or stories won't come your way.
But all of these things, the embargo, the super injunction, all of these things in the past probably had more strength to them than they do now, because we've got 24-hour news, right?
Yeah.
So, and we've got social media, and we've got XYZ. So is there any point really in it? I mean, these super injunctions, because somebody on Twitter, right, they don't care. They don't know the law. They don't know the rules. If they get hold of a story, they're just going to put it out there. And then the super injunction or the embargo looks stupid.
No, but I think they'll end up in prison, though. So,
if they've got more than 400 followers.
Is that right? Is it
more
than 400?
Yeah, it's 400. It was set.
Is that right?
It was set a few years ago.
So that guy in his boxer shorts in his bedroom, blogging away.
Yeah, but exactly that. If he's got
50,
one or two, which they normally only do have one or two followers.
But what if someone who's got 1,000 followers then retweets them? But they both get done, or only the guy who's got 1,000 followers gets done?
Only the guy who's got 1,000 followers, in my view.
But as a responsible media outlet, it's still on them not to report that, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's the thing.
I can't remember where that test case came from. It was...
There was a lord involved. There was
and it was the paedophilia claims.
Yes, he was accused of...
Separately, there was that...
The judge said 400.
Instance of... I said, well, not great, it's bad, but when Sally Berko... Just tweeted out.
That was it.
Was that the same one?
Yeah,
that was the same one.
We should put smiley face. Why is this trending? Smiley face.
Yeah.
But she had more than 400 followers. The judge said.
Was that why? Because it wasn't like, you know, you could argue it both ways. Yeah. I mean, obviously, we all know what the implication of what was being said.
Obviously, yeah.
That was very costly for John Burke. I think it cost she had to pay like £50,000 plus costs. I think.
But again, there's the opposite
that was a test
side
case,
of it,
wasn't it?
Was it right?
Yeah.
And it's the opposite side of social media these days as well, that if you do end up breaking these things, if you do end up putting it out there that a certain celebrity has done a certain thing, then you can get cancelled yourself.
Mm.
And so, you know, the media outlet that decides to do that is suddenly the big, nasty presence that, oh, no, well, you need to be shut down now. So it's you've got to be very, very careful And that's what social media has done.
It's very, very... It just fascinates me, actually, that people on Twitter or other social media outlets honestly act with no rules.
Act with impunity. They're
just
don't
complete
they?
Impunity and know that perhaps nothing's going to happen.
But, I mean, this is also why they should be this sort of, I think, get rid of the anonymity on Twitter.
Yeah.
So people can face up to the consequences.
Oh, I'd love that.
Of what they say, especially the people who are pumping out so much bile.
But personally, like Facebook and YouTube, they are very clear as to what we can, you know, as a media outlet can put on there as well now. So they are very powerful. And you think the internet is supposed to be the Wild West, but I mean, they sometimes have more power than something like Ofcom in terms of being able to shut you off, because you rely on things like Facebook.
Actually, TikTok's pretty powerful on medical misinformation.
Yeah, well, yeah, like so is YouTube and so is Facebook and things like that. Now they have the power. It's odd that these big social media giants are the ones now with the big power.
Let's have a look at those people who lost their power this week. A PR cock-up of the week. Giles, we'll start with you.
I mean, I've used this one before, but I think the whole Harry and Meghan soap opera, where we've seen the trail for their Netflix coming out, where they once again are doing the best to sort of air their laundry, dirty laundry in public, I think ultimately is going to backfire on them. And they're looking, it's a law of diminishing returns.
Yeah,
I think they're becoming shriller and shriller. I do feel very sorry for Prince Charles. You know, it will be a big short-term headache for him as he's trying to sort of show the royal family to be modern and, you know, and they are facing somewhat of this existential crisis. But you just kind of think, like, what are you hoping to achieve? Okay, it's all about money, but it's like, you know, it is very much trying to play the victim card the whole time. And I just think it's something, maybe I'm being very British about it, but this is something quite unseemly about the way they're both behaving, notwithstanding that they've made their point.
But they have just won an award for
fighting racism.
They're doing all right.
You've heard before, okay? Like, we've heard the story, so it's like, okay, fine. But you know, I mean, like, what? You know, how?
Is the Prince and Princess of Wales now? They're laughing at it now. Times it's saying, "Oh, we're just laughing."
I think the worst thing is, aren't they on tour in America?
Yeah,
they are.
So it's just kind of perfect storm.
Yeah.
Well, there's a rumour that the timing of the trail was put out,
of course,
to upset.
And now the Waleses, a source in the Times was saying that they now call them the Kardashians over there. So they just see them as a funny couple living in America now. That's what the family are trying to say.
That's what they're trying to
say.
But when that book comes out I mean, it's going to hit the fan, isn't it, in a big way?
Oh, all right.
Nick, what's your PR cock-up of the week?
It's Winter Wonderland. Now, it's that place in Hyde Park, and tourists from all over the
beautiful
country
have
gone there. I went there about 10 years ago, and I hated it.
Yeah.
I was almost sick. You know, they've got all that gloopy, chocolatey sort of drinks.
Did you eat everything?
I had a bit of that, and then I went on one of the Wurlitzer stuff, and I did almost go green, so I hate the place anyway.
Mrs. Booker there?
I took Mrs. Booker and the two little Bookers as well, and they loved it, and they loved the fact that I hated it. And it was pretty costly then, but this week, it turns out the prices have gone up even more there. So you can go and see, you go to the Santa's Grotto.
Yeah.
That's free. Lovely. That's good. Woo-hoo.
Nice.
But if you want
a present.
If you want a picture, it's 10 quid. Right. If you want a potato, just to eat a potato on that
place.
Oh,
I thought you meant as a present.
No. Well,
eat a potato.
If you want a potato, just a jacket potato.
Right.
7 quid.
Take your own.
Candy floss, 8 quid.
Really? All right, so I was just in Miami.
8 quid.
Well, I can beat that. I was in Miami. Guess how much a pint of beer was?
Go on, 30 quid.
£15.
Good lord.
And a pizza was $50. Like, how can a pizza be $50? Not in anywhere very
is it any
nice.
Good?
No. It wasn't even in a nice place. Yeah.
Do you want to name and shame? so Winter Wonderland.
Well, here's one woman. This is in the Sun. Yeah. Like, one woman named Winnie that they spoke to was tucking into a hot dog covered in onions and sauce in the Bavarian village area.
Nice.
She said it was expensive. It was £9.50. It's a special one, but it's delicious, but it's a little too expensive.
It would have been Bockwurst or Bratwurst.
£9.50.
£9.50. That is an outrage, isn't it? But I guess people are paying it. How is a PR? Would you defend that?
I wouldn't defend it. I think it's indefensible. Especially in a cost of living crisis.
You turn around, point at the crowd and say, look at all them morons.
Look at you, guys, thank you very much indeed. Mick Booker, Giles Kenningham. That's all for this week. Thank you for listening. And you may be pleased to know that there's no gagging us. So I'll be back with my trusty panel next week for more Hacks and Flax. Until then, I need a hot dog. Hacks and Flax is presented by me, Petri Hoskin, produced by Amanda Redman, and brought to you by Trafalgar Strategy. If you want to get in touch with your take on the current news climate, you can do that by emailing us at hackflackpod@gmail.com. And don't forget to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time on Hacks and Flax.